Since his election in 2006, Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio has sat on the Senate floor at a mahogany desk with a proud history. And Desk 88, eight progressive senators who changed America, he tells the stories of eight senators seated there before him, revealing how much, whatever their flaws, made a decisive contribution to creating a more just America. Some of the senators who sat in that desk before him, Hugo Black, Glenn Taylor, Herbert Lehman, Al Gore Sr., William Proxmire, RFK, and George McGovern. The name of the new book is Desk 88. Sherrod Brown is a Democrat from Ohio, the senior senator of that state, and it's a great pleasure to welcome him to the roundtable this morning. Senator Brown, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Mr. Donahue. Appreciate your work.
What brought you to want to tell these stories of the eight senators who were seated before you?
Well, when you're elected to the Senate, I was in 06, my first term, and you, the freshman, because we're last in seniority, look on the floor. There are 10 desks that are unoccupied that the freshmen are going to hold, and we just look around the floor to see which ones to choose by seniority, and they all kind of look the same, and they're all close to the, you're in the Senate. So I started to pull out desk drawers because I had heard that senators carve their names in their desk drawer. And so I look at this one desk, and it said McGovern, South Dakota, Hugo Black, Alabama, Al Gore, Tennessee. And then it just said Kennedy. So I went over to Ted. I said, Ted, come here a second. Ted Kennedy walks over, and I say, which brother's desk is this? And he said, well, it's got to be Bobby's because I have Jack's. So I took that desk. And I was pretty excited, obviously. How could you not be? And I started looking at the names of the other senators, and it occurred, I love history. And I just thought, I could write about these senators and what they did to make the country more progressive. And I think you learn from history. And always studying history always gives me hope for the future, because these eight senators I chose, they pushed through the Senate collective bargaining and Social Security and Medicare and civil rights and all the things that I think make us a more prosperous country. And those were all victories for progressives and victories for the country. And so I chose these eight senators to write about.
It seems fascinating to me that this is such an incredible list. I mean, I guess, I don't know. Are there other desks that you look at that have a history such as this, or is this really something special?
That's a good question. I've not really gone through other desks. I think that, there are a number of these eight that people have never heard of. If you live in Rhode Island, maybe you've heard of Theodore Francis Green because they named the airport after him, but people don't really know much about him anymore. There's one senator from Idaho named Glenn Taylor, who ran for vice president in 1948 on the progressive ticket. He's pretty much lost to history too, but he was, when he was campaigning for vice president, he spoke to an integrated audience in 1948 in Birmingham, and he was arrested and spent the night in Bull Connor's jail. So there are stories about all of them. I think you could pick any number of desks and find giants in the Senate at those desks, and also people who have contributed something to our country, especially on the Democratic side, to progressives, but maybe aren't that well known, but that played an important role.
The idea in the book, as you say in the subtitle, Eight Progressive Senators Who Changed America, what do you believe defines that makes those senators and even someone today a progressive?
Well, history, Emerson said that history is a battle between the innovators and the conservators. We'd say progressives and conservatives, and the conservatives want to preserve and hold on to their wealth and privilege and status, and progressives want to move the country forward. And that means using government to improve people's lives. And so while conservatives typically defend special interests, it might be in today's world, it's the drug companies and the oil companies and the gun lobby. Progressives want to use government to expand Medicare or to fight for Social Security or to address climate change or to fight for gun safety. So I think that the battles of Hugo Black, the first senator I talked to, who started off as a KKK member, literally, and ended up as a progressive civil libertarian on the Supreme Court, where his law school actually burned him in effigy after he sided with progressives on integration as a member of the court. The battles that went on between the conservators and the innovators in the 1920s and 30s go on today, where the people that have money and have their representatives at the Wall Street Journal editorial board and Fox News and the lobbyists they have to protect them if they're Wall Street, the fight is there between progressives and those who are trying to hold on to their wealth and privilege. That really never stops throughout history. And the reason I'm optimistic about the future, even with the president incumbent in the White House, the reason I'm optimistic in the future is because there is hope when you look at what progressives have done through the course of history and will do again.
Let us look for a moment at your state of Ohio and a swing state, considered, of course, a swing state. What is the status of progressivism in the state of Ohio, which ultimately asks the question of where do you fit into that?
Well, good question. We're an increasingly conservative state. Well, I'll put it this way. Our state has become more Republican in the last 20 years. And while some other states in the South, for instance, that have become more diverse and where younger people migrate to tend to be more, they're getting more progressive. What Ohio's response to that, the progressive movement, if you will, is there are a lot of younger Ohioans, particularly women, particularly people of color under about 45, that are active and in many cases influential and powerful in local governments that are beginning to fight back. And while Democrats and progressives tended to have lost in most of the last 10 years in Ohio, in statewide governor, Senate races, presidential, we're coming back on building from the bottom up. And progressive movements typically are, when progressives get elected and progressives change things, it really is from the grassroots up. I mean, I wear in my lapel a depiction of a canary in a birdcage. The mine workers 100 years ago took a canary in the mines. If a canary died from toxic gas or lack of oxygen, the mine worker got out of the mine. He had no government to protect him in those days or no union strong enough to. But what people did in their union halls and in their church organizations and their in advocating for children and civil rights groups was to fight back. And that's why we see now workers' compensation and civil rights and Medicare and Social Security and a fight for climate change, that progressives really come from the bottom up. And that's what will rebuild Ohio, if you will. Ohio suffered a lot in the last 10 years, partly because of conservative government. We're shamefully high on infant mortality and on maternal health and all the issues that should define a humane culture and a humane country. We've got to do better, and I think we're doing better from the bottom up.
Is it a microcosm of the United States? I mean, the sense that I get, and even reading your story, of looking at, here you are, the senior senator of that state, a state who also has had John Kasich as its governor, a state who has also gone red and may very well go red in 2020. What does that tell us about the divide in our politics?
Well, it tells us that you need new energy to ever move the country forward. I mean, the people in Ohio state government has been pretty much captured by interest groups. I mean, a big utility company just got a huge bailout from taxpayers that was just absolutely reproachable. I mean, it was something that reprehensible that we see too much of that, because this legislature is in the gun lobby's pocket, is in the drug companies' pockets, and what you need is a new surge of energy, and that comes from young people. We're starting to see more young people want to stay in Ohio, moving to Columbus, moving to Cincinnati or Cleveland, moving to smaller cities in Ohio. And I think that's the resurgence. But our decline relative to the country in terms of progressives has mirrored our economic decline of foreclosures and infant mortality and unemployment levels and wages. And that comes back when we begin to attract more young people into the state. And that's our challenge. And that will absolutely parallel the progressive change in the state.
As you mentioned just a few moments ago, you came to the U.S. Senate in 2006. That was during the Bush administration, and then 8 years of President Obama and now President Trump. Give us a sense of what that has been like for you to see the differences in style of those three men, but also of just how the Senate has reacted and what you make of that body, especially now as so many progressives, so many Democrats, so many people on the left and even moderates who look to the Senate to be the conscience of the country and try to change what many of us see as great disregard to the Constitution.
Well, I started in Congress in the early 90s, and I didn't think twice about taking on the president of my party on the North American Free Trade Agreement. It was one of the things I was most involved in opposing. And even though it was a new president, I was a new member of Congress in my own party, I was willing to stand up with the president when he signed the Defense of Marriage Act, which history has shown, I think, me to be on the right side, and them, the Republicans and some Democrats like Bill Clinton on the wrong side in terms of marriage equality. So in those days, people were more willing to stand up to the president of their own party if they saw him erring in some sense. And so when I came to the Senate, it was the end of the Bush era. The last 2 years, there was no energy left much. They had tried to privatize Social Security. They got slapped down. He made terrible mistakes on the Iraq War, and those of us that voted against it didn't gloat, but we're trying to find a way out. But then the Obama years and then the Trump years, and what's the most, to me, maybe the most discouraging thing I've seen in my entire Senate service is how Republican senators, my colleagues, many of whom I know them all personally, many of whom I like, but have just have relinquished their role and abandoned their principles in making all kinds of excuses for this president. I know what they say privately. I know a significant number of Republican senators think Trump's a racist. A significant number of Republican senators thinks he lies all the time and think he doesn't have the integrity that a president should have. Yet I know that talking to them privately, yet publicly they're not willing to show the kind of courage they need to show. And I don't know if it's because they got the tax cuts from this president they wanted for rich people. I don't know if it's because of the judges. I don't know if it's because they're scared of their Republican base and losing in a primary. But history, one of the things that Desk 88, my book, taught me is that history will not judge them kindly for not standing up to a president that has done the number of impeachable things he's done. And Richard Nixon, I was not in Congress then, of course, many years ago, but Richard Nixon didn't do half the things that President Trump clearly has done. And that's pretty troubling that you know, Republicans called out Richard Nixon in the end, and he resigned. Republicans have not said boo, except Mitt Romney, perhaps, being the exception, have not said boo about this president.
What does it say about the party as a whole, both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, but especially the GOP, when you have a House vote on the impeachment probe and not one Republican votes for impeachment? That shows a great divide, of course, within the country as well as within the House of Representatives. But it also shows a loyalty where there seems to be a lot of smoke. And are they waiting for fire? Or, as you say, the conversations go on every day and there are great concerns. But what changes that that is not as lopsided as it has been?
Well, that's a million-dollar question. I don't know. I think every week we're seeing something worse with the president. We're seeing another career diplomat, another career soldier, another West Point graduate, another Medal of Honor, another Purple Heart winner step up and say that what this president did was impeachable and wrong and contrary to federal law or to our Constitution, that to ask another country to get involved in our elections. All those things that, and again, Richard Nixon never did. I don't know what it takes for Republicans to finally stand up on it. It's hard for me to figure why. In the end, I mean, I understand the politics of not doing it. They've got a lot of Trump voters at home that voted for them that'll be mad if they do it. But at some point, you care first about your country and second about your party. And I think I did that when Bill Clinton was president, when I thought he was wrong on things. I'm still just pretty perplexed about what it's going to take for Republican House and Senate members to do the right thing here.
When you look at the work that has been done over the years at Desk 88, and you look at what you are faced with every day, what does it come down to? What lessons do you learn from those who came before you? And I ask the question because I often wonder, it seems that we are doing a lot of retreading, and we don't often look at that history to understand where we've been and where we're headed.
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, history, it really does repeat itself in many ways. I mean, as I said earlier, the battles between the progressives and the people who are trying to preserve their power and their wealth and their social class, that battle is nothing new that we're seeing today from what we saw in the 1920s or 30s with Hugo Black, or the 1950s with Al Gore Sr., or Herbert Lehman from your state of New York. So I think those battles are just going to be fought over and over. I think, though, it's important if you want to have hope for the future. And, you know, I hear people all the time saying this is the worst time in our country's history. Well, it isn't. I mean, the worst time, Trump may be the worst president. I think he is in my lifetime. He may be the worst president in history, but, you know, I didn't know much about James Buchanan, as bad as he was before the Civil War. But whether he is or not, it's not the worst time for our country. I mean, it's not the 1950s with McCarthy. It's not World War II or the Depression. It's not the Civil War. So we have great divisions, but we're not that divided. And we recover from this. But I just, writing Desk 88 and researching this book for 10 years and reading literally 150 books about these senators and these eras in American politics and other things, taught me that we will recover from this, that there is a lot of reason to still be optimistic, even when people think times are just awful, because we're a resilient country. These eight senators I wrote about, understanding all of them were eight white men. That's who was mostly in the Senate. Understanding in the next 20 or 30 years, I hope that I expect that women or people of color and people of color will hold this desk and fight on a lot of these issues.
One of your grandchildren took their fingers and put their hands over the desk and felt the engravings, and said to your wife, it felt scruffy. Is politics seems, even though it's often held, we hope that it can be held to a great standard, it is scruffy, isn't it? And I guess the question I ask is, does it always have to be scruffy?
Well, I nobody's asked. That was a great question. That was when I carved my desk, my name in the desk. My grandchildren. This is the 4-year-old that said this, and she, they were more interested in riding the Senate subway across to the Capitol than they were in seeing their grandfather carve their name in a piece of old furniture. But she ran her finger over the actual carving and said that. That's a great way to ask the question. Democracy is scruffy. I mean, whatever scruffy actually means. Democracy is messy. It never works easily. There are everybody's flawed that practices it. We have people that are willing to stand on principle all the time. We have people that are willing to sell their souls for 30 pieces of silver. And so that's what politics is, pretty much a cross section of our country with some very honorable people and some less honorable people in it. Yet we persevere, but that's what, again, that's what makes me, Mr. Donahue, makes me optimistic about the future, is that even in the really bad times over those 60 or so years that I wrote about, and then the time since, in modern times, even during this time, we've seen major setbacks, but we're a pretty resilient country and a pretty great country, and we come back from things. And that's why I do think politics will always be scruffy. Democracy is always scruffy, but we persevere as a country in spite of it.
The name of the new book is Desk 88, Eight Progressive Senators Who Changed America. Sherrod Brown is the senior U.S. Senator from Ohio. Senator Brown, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much.
What a good interview.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Donahue.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Be well. Again, the name of the new book is Desk 88. The book is published by FSG. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.